Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756. And now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
In for a real treat this morning from Mary Washington Healthcare, Dr. Alan Hardy is here. Dr. Hardy, good morning. Good to have you here this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
A lot of the topics I think we're going to talk about today, a lot of people are dealing with and talking about. How did you get in? Tell us your journey to how you chose the specialty field that you're in.
Sure. So we were talking about this a little bit earlier. So kind of two things led me to where I am now with gastroenterology and obesity medicine. So growing up, I always had weight issues. I grew up in Durham, North Carolina. And I had weight issues most of my life. I would say my entire life. The other thing was I was like a comic book nerd. So me and my friends, we grew up collecting comic books, Spider-Man, X-Men, stuff like that. So fast forward, and I'm going from high school to college, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And at the time, I wanted to go into business. So I was taking an introductory biology course, and my genetics professor, this was down at Hampton University, Dr. Edison Folks, told us that if we wanted to be, going into business, if we wanted to take the business world by storm, we should actually go into biology or genetics. And he was going to try to mix the genome of a wild strawberry plant that could survive harsh winters with a domesticated strawberry plant that tasted good. And therefore, he was going to do that, and he was going to become a millionaire. And to all of us freshmen sitting there, this sounded amazing. Right. And we're like, oh, man, we should do this. Well, because I was always interested in, the genome and genetics because of my interest in X-Men, I was like, oh, I could become a genetic surgeon. Maybe I could do that. But now that was kind of pulling me away from my business interest. Being a freshman, sophomore in college, I also realized very quickly that when you told girls you were going to be pre-med, you got a few more looks. So I kind of started saying that, and I eventually changed my major to biology pre-med. But really, the pre-med part was more so I was interested in going into genetics. So Fast forward again, I was applying to MD-PhD programs, ended up getting into the MD-PhD program at VCU in Richmond, Virginia. And what I didn't realize, I guess kids today don't realize how much power they have in their hands with these smartphones. But, I was kind of going in blind. I was the first person in my immediate family to go into medicine. So I had no idea that a lot of those courses didn't overlap. A lot of MD-PhD courses overlapped. And so people would get a PhD in anatomy, and their entire program might be 5 or 6 years. After I got into the program, I found out that those courses didn't overlap if you were getting your PhD in genetics, and that my program would be closer to 9 or 10 years.
9 or 10 years?
Yeah. So when you tell that to a 22-year-old, suddenly you're thinking, well, you feel like you're going to spend your whole life in school. And I was like, oh, I'm not doing that. That's crazy. I can't do that. Oh, my God, I'd be 30. And when you're 22, 30 seems like you're ancient,
yeah,
right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally.
You're like, oh, 30? I'll be old. Now 30 seems like you're a kid. So I ended up leaving the MD-PhD program, finishing with an MD. But along the way, I was always interested in obesity because, again, I always had weight issues. And I don't know if it was my innate interest in weight management that made me more interested in gastroenterology or that it just naturally came easier to me. But I found that I didn't have to work as hard to understand gastroenterology as I did some of the other courses. I had to just work harder.
Yeah.
So as I came out of medical school, I was thinking, I want to go into gastroenterology. And I ended up getting into the gastroenterology program at Howard University Hospital up in Washington, D.C. Ended up doing an advanced year of endoscopy training at UNC Chapel Hill, kind of going back home. One of the things that bothered me, though, is that throughout all of my medical training, whether in medical school, residency, fellowship, I didn't learn anything about obesity. I would sit in on cardiology courses, endocrine courses, and they would talk about heart disease, they would talk about diabetes, and they would usually end the lectures by saying things like, so make sure you talk to your patients about eating healthy. And that's when I would perk up, and then the lecture would be over.
Yeah.
Or they talk about diabetes, they say, so you have to get your patients to eat healthy, and I would perk up, and then the lecture would be over. And I was like, okay, where do we get to the part about eating healthy? And at the time in the 90s, eating healthy meant eat low fat. And so I was eating low fat, you know. Turns out, I won't name the candy, but there were a lot of candies that were low in fat.
Yeah.
And I was gaining weight, and I could not figure out why I was gaining weight. And then I finally got to my internship year, maybe second year of residency. I was at Howard University Hospital. And one of my best friends from undergrad, who also had weight issues, he's a clinical psychologist now, he told me he was doing Atkins. And I said, oh, don't do Atkins, you're going to die.
Right, because that's you always heard that.
Yeah, I said, you're going to eat all that fat, you're going to die, man, don't do that. He said, yeah, okay. So he came into town for a conference, and this guy had probably dropped 80 or 90 pounds. And you know, when people are like really big and they lose weight, they look like a lollipop, right? Their head suddenly looks big.
Yeah.
So when I first saw him, I didn't realize it was him. I like walked right by him, and he was like, hey, Alan. And I looked, and I was like, oh my gosh, what happened to you? He said, I've been working out. I was like, no. What have you been doing? I've been working out and I gained 5 pounds. What have you been doing? He said, I did Atkins. And at that point I said, okay, I don't care if I die. I want to look good in the casket. So what did, tell me what you did. He's like, I can't tell you, just buy the book and read the book. So I said, okay. So he bought the book for me. It was like my birthday. He buys the Atkins book for me. And I'm reading the book over the next couple weeks. And I'm looking for the secret. And all I can figure out is that he's eating real food. He's saying to eat real food. Like avoid a lot of added sugars, avoid a lot of processed foods, avoid a lot of man-made foods. But basically you're eating real foods. You know, maybe don't eat potatoes and stuff like that, rice, pasta. But other than that, you're pretty much eating real food. So now I'm a resident. I don't have a lot of money. I'm living up in the D.C. area. My younger brother is my roommate because we can't afford to live anywhere else. So I'm basically living off of like chicken wings and Caesar salad and Diet Coke, right? So here's the other thing. You can do low carb the healthy way. You can do it the unhealthy way. It'll still work, right? So yeah, if you
can. So it worked.
It worked. I dropped 30 pounds in about 3 months. And people in my program, they didn't know what was going on. They just saw me dropping weight. My clothes were hanging off of me. I mean, and you were talking Washington, D.C., early 2000s. You know, they thought maybe I had HIV/AIDS. They thought I had cancer. I didn't know they were taking bets on what was going on with me. So I was in noon conference one day, and one girl in my program, she whispers to me, she says, hey, Hardy, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. She said, you've been losing a lot of weight real quick. I said, yeah, I'm doing Atkins. I thought we were whispering. 30 people behind me are like, oh! I didn't realize like the whole department had been paying attention to my weight loss because it happened so quick. They're like, that's what's going on. So it happened very quick. But here's the problem. I didn't understand how to do low carb. I thought once I lost the weight, that was it. I won, right? Because that's what you think. Everybody's like, oh, once if I could just lose these 20 pounds, I'll be fine. I didn't realize that what you do to lose the weight, you have to continue to do to keep it off. So think of it this way. If you had high blood pressure and you take medicine and your blood pressure comes down and you stop taking the medicine, what's going to happen? Your blood pressure is going to go back up. Well, I wasn't smart enough to realize that. So I ate this way. I ate low carb. I stopped eating all the sugar and I only drank diet stuff or water. And I stopped eating the bread and the pasta and I dropped all this weight. And as soon as I dropped the weight, I was like, all right, I won.
I'm here.
And I went back to eating how I ate before, and then the weight came back plus 10 pounds.
Mm.
And I yo-yoed like that for the next 10 to 15 years, okay? So you go to about 2017, and I'm practicing gastroenterology. I'm out at Augusta Health in Fishersville, Virginia. And I get some labs done, and my liver enzymes are high. And the problem is, as a physician, you know what it is. I knew it was fatty liver. I was the highest I had ever been. I was about 250, 252 pounds. Never been that big. And I said, this is fatty liver. I know what this is. I know how to lose weight. I don't know how to keep it off. At the same time, people were talking about gastric balloons. They were talking about endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty, some of these GI procedures that we could do to help people lose weight. So I went to a program outside of Chicago, Illinois, the GI program, to get training on how to do some of these procedures. And at that program, this is a gastroenterology program sponsored by the American Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, ASGE. I met a physician there who said, Alan, are you interested in treating obesity or do you just want to learn some fancy procedures? And I said, no, I want to treat obesity, partly because I wanted to treat myself. She said, you need to join the Obesity Medicine Association. Now, this is like 2017. I've been practicing since 2010, 2012. I have no idea what she's talking about. Huh. I've never heard of this organization before. I said, who are they? She said, go online, look them up. This is the largest group of clinicians, providers in America that treat obesity. So I looked them up, and it totally has changed my practice. I met a physician there who did a lot of work with Virta Health. I'm blanking on her name right now. She actually taught me how to do low carb. She taught me about finding your number, right? So low carb for me would be different than low carb for you or low carb for the next 10 people. Because of biological diversity, we're all different. So maybe for me, I have to eat less than 30 net carbs a day. Maybe the next person has to stay less than 50. Maybe the next person is less than 70. The problem with people who are doing Atkins originally, this is 20 years ago, is that everybody did less than 20, and then that was it. People didn't graduate up appropriately to find out what their number was, right? So what I try to do with my practice is help people find their number, help coach them into like which path is the right path for you to be on. Should you be at less than 30? Should you be at less than 70? What's going to work best for you? Because I could prescribe something for you, but it doesn't matter if you're only going to be on it for, 30 days.
Yeah.
We need to find something that's going to work for you for the next 30 years for it to really change your life. And a lot of people think they have to lose a ton of weight to improve their health. You only have to lose about 7 to 10% of your total body weight to really improve your health. So being a member of that organization, the Obesity Medicine Association, has really changed how I practice medicine. It's changed how I practice gastroenterology. And I think it's helped not just my patients, it's helped me personally too.
Quick break. What a fascinating story, and to hear how how you've gotten from here to there, and how you're able to tell patients. Dr. Alan Hardy with Mary Washington Healthcare this morning. Quick break. We'll be back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can listen to Town Talk anytime, day or night. Just subscribe to the Town Talk podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And now, here's your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Alan Hardy here this morning from Mary Washington Healthcare. Your story, Dr. Hardy, is so interesting just because, your patients are the real beneficiaries of all of this. I mean, you've seen it all. And you now have you're now able to talk to patients, I think, in a different way than most physicians can.
I hope so. I tell a lot of my patients that I've made every possible mistake.
Yeah.
Trying to lose excess weight. So my goal is, if I made these mistakes between 2003 and 2017, so I made 14 years of mistakes. If I can get them to crunch that time down to maybe 4 months. Then I'm going to declare victory, right?
Yeah.
So you can't make a mistake that I haven't made, right? So, and the other thing too is if you look at the behavioral aspects of this, because with OMA, the Obesity Medicine Association, we look at nutrition, we look at physical activity, we look at medications, right, which can add weight to you, medications that are FDA approved for weight loss, medications that are not FDA approved but do promote weight loss. We also look at behavioral issues. Which includes mindful eating. And that's a big part of it too, because you can look at nutrition and most obesity medicine doctors will tell you that 80 to 90% of weight loss for most people is gonna be based on what you eat. But the mindfulness part really controls everything else, how you think, right? Your brain is gonna control everything else. So sometimes if you're not aware of what you're doing to yourself, you might have all the best intentions in the world, but you're not aware of how bad certain foods are for you. Right, so you might not be aware that eating a slice of bread is just as bad as maybe a couple spoonfuls of sugar in terms of what it's going to do when it gets in your body. Right, I've had patients say things like, "Well, I can't eat low carb," and I'll look at them and I'm trying to inhale, exhale because I'm thinking to myself, "Well, modern man, modern woman has been around for about 300,000 years. We've only been eating bread for about 10 to 15,000 years. And I guarantee you the bread that they were making 10,000 years ago is not like what you see in the grocery store now
right. That
stays soft for a week, right?
Yeah.
It's probably more like if you went to your local baker and you bought that sourdough and like by day two, it's a brick. That's probably closer to the kind of bread that they were eating 10,000 years ago. without all of the preservatives and things like that. So when people say they can't eat low carb, I have to have my bread, it's, I'm thinking, well, humans did fine not eating bread for about 290,000 years. We made it. So right. Technically, you can go without eating bread. It is possible, right? Pasta has only been around for a couple thousand years. Granulated sugar has only been around for a couple thousand years. What people underestimate is the addictive quality of these foods. So you have to keep in mind that we evolved to like sweetness. Mm-hmm. The food industry knows that. The food industry, I don't want to call them evil, but they're trying to make money, right? They're in it for profit. So, and there are a lot of books that have been written about this. So Michael Moss wrote a book called Salt, Sugar, Fat, where he talks about how the food industry, when they realize that we have this addictive nature with sugar, and you get this release of dopamine, that if they can add sugar to things, we're more likely to buy it. So will we buy mustard? Yeah, but we'll really buy honey mustard. Right? Will we buy tomato sauce? Yeah, we will. But you put a sprinkle a little bit of sugar in there, we'll like it even more. So anything that we like, you put a little sugar in there, we'll like it even more. One person told me, if you look at most colas, there's a lot of salt. You wouldn't drink something that has that much salt, but if you put enough sugar in there, if you make it sweet enough, that overrides our taste buds, and now we like it. So even the idea of mouthfeel. So this is something that came up, I believe, in the 80s, as I read about it in his book. Mouthfeel is the idea that humans have evolved to like the sensation of fat in our mouths. So you hear people talking about, I want a nice juicy ribeye, right? Because that fat feels good in our mouth, because over hundreds of thousands of years, that fat meant that we were going to survive. It meant survival of the human race. But in nature, fatty things aren't sweet and sweet things aren't fatty, right? So you can have a fatty piece of meat in nature, it's not sweet. And you can have fruit, it's sweet, but it's not fatty. But man will combine those things. So now you're eating a lot, because you get that dopamine release when you eat something that's sweet, and you're eating a lot more of that fatty substance than you would normally eat. Because normally if you eat a lot of fat, you become satiated.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff that you start to learn, and you kind of start to take a step back and realize, wow, people are fighting this uphill battle and they don't even know it. They're not even aware that their biology is being used against them. So I have, you know, I have these kind of like these weight loss myths that I usually try to correct in the first few visits, that I believed, that most of us have been told, you know, that saturated fat is bad. Well, it's not necessarily bad. And some of these myths have been corrected, but you don't even know they've been corrected. So I think in 2020, the Journal of the American College of Cardiology came out talking about saturated fat, and you can look this up online. They said that saturated fat in the form of whole fat, dairy, unprocessed, and I say unprocessed red meat, and dark chocolate is not associated with an increased risk of heart disease or diabetes, and there's no reason to limit intake. You would think that would have been broadcast everywhere.
Should be a headline.
Right. And it would have been, except that in 2020, we were dealing with COVID-19.
Right.
So nothing else mattered then, right? That knocked everything else off the table. Everybody was thinking about COVID. And I stumbled across that article maybe in 2021, 2022. And when I saw it, I was thinking, wait a second, this is huge. This is huge. Something else I stumbled across, and this is embarrassing as a gastroenterologist. I did not ever learn this at a GI conference. I was reading a book that I heard about from Dr. Eric Westman. He's like a low-carb guru down at Duke University. This was at a conference a couple years ago. He told me about a textbook. Of course, I don't remember the name of the textbook now. I'd have to get it to you. But he said, if I had a fellowship program, I would have all of my fellows read this textbook. So I'm reading the textbook. But I can tell you this. In the field of paleobiology, they have gone in and they've looked at the acidity of the human stomach. And what they have found is that animals that evolved from meat eaters or eating meat tend to have highly acidic stomachs. The idea is that if your ancestors ate meat, you're likely to come across a pathogen that would kill you. So you needed to have a highly acidic stomach to kill off whatever was in there.
Sure.
So if you look at herbivores, like cows, for example, they have more alkaline stomachs, or they have an alkaline part of their stomach, because the bacteria that are going to break down those plants have to survive in an alkaline environment. It suggests that our ancestors did evolve eating meat because we have highly acidic stomachs. Not only do we have highly acidic stomachs, but our stomachs are so acidic, our stomachs are actually more acidic than most carnivores, our stomachs actually approach the acidic of, and I forgot the kind of animal it is, but like a vulture that eats meat that has actually been dead for a while. Because if something dies, the natural defenses that would keep bacteria at bay are now gone. So when you think about the level of acidity that our stomachs normally have, and as a gastroenterologist, I was reading this in a book that was geared towards teaching people to eat low carb, and I'm thinking, how am I learning this now? So there's a lot of stuff that we haven't learned in medicine, and when I say we, physicians, that's out there, right? And if we haven't learned it, a lot of patients haven't learned it. So, and I'm talking in circles, but it's very exciting and frustrating at the same time, how much information is out there and how much you can stumble across.
You talked a few minutes ago about finding your carb number.
Yeah.
How do I do that?
So with my patients, you can kind of do it two ways. You can sit down for several days and just record what you're eating, do a food log. I do this. This is, I think, the best way to do it. I only do it with about half my patients because people are busy, right? So if you can do a food log for 5 to 7 days, write down everything you eat, find out how many net carbs are in that food. Net carbs would be total carbs minus the fiber. So for example, if an apple has 20 total carbs and maybe 3 grams of fiber, 20 minus 3 is 17. So that would be 17 net carbs.
Okay.
Do that for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, every day for 5 to 7 days. And you get an average of how many net carbs you're eating a day. That gives you an idea of how many carbs you're eating, and that got you to where you are now. So maybe you're averaging 150 net carbs a day. Well, if that person comes in and they're averaging 150 net carbs a day, I would say, hey, why don't you drop down to less than 70? Let's see how that works. Now, that's question number one. The next thing I tell them is, you don't have to do this every day for the rest of your life. Maybe let's do this 6 days out of seven, 9 days out of 10, because life happens, right? There's going to be a birthday. There's going to be a retirement party. There's going to be a celebration.
Right.
Somebody's going to stress you out at work, right? So I'd much rather you have a donut than punch somebody in the face. Like, don't do that, right? When you get stressed out, fine, have that cookie. That's your cheat day. Don't worry about it. Because what I find is some people who are focused at being like all or nothing, they'll eat, you know, less than 50 net carbs a day for 3 months straight. And then one day they have a slice of pizza and then that's it. They walk away and they never eat that way again. So I failed them at that point. So my thing is, no, this is consistency. This is a lifestyle. You're going to be doing this for the next 30, 40, 50 years. So find a way that you can live. So if it's less than 70 net carbs a day, if it's less than 50, and if it's 6 days out of seven, and you know you have that one day a week or 2 or 3 days a month where you can do whatever you want to do, it's definitely harder in the beginning because there's an addictive nature, right? And there's a psychological aspect to this too. So for example, and this goes to mindful eating, what you eat, when you eat, where you eat, why you eat. So are you eating that hot dog and having that beer because you really want it or because every time your dad took you to the baseball game,
exactly,
that's what he used to get?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe your dad didn't get you the beer when you were a little kid, but hopefully not. Or, you know, for me, every time I go to the movie theater, I have to have a soft drink and butter popcorn.
Yeah.
Am I really hungry or is that psychological? At least being aware of that. Now, I can plan for that because I guarantee you if I go to the movie theater, I'm going to have butter popcorn. But if I know I'm going to do that, maybe I don't have 3 slices of pizza the night before.
Interesting. Dr. Alan Hardy here, Mary Washington Healthcare. We'll take a quick break and continue on. Good stuff this morning. On News Talk 1230 WFVA, it's 831.
From the Fredericksburg FreePress.com studios, this is News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can access all episodes of Town Talk online at newstalk1230.net or on your favorite podcast platform. And now, here's your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Ellen Hardy in this morning from Mary Washington Healthcare as we talk about obesity and management and things like that. Good, really good stuff. When should I come to see you? Are there symptoms that I have or what? When should I consider coming to you?
So anytime you have blood in the stool, I'd say blood in the stool, severe abdominal pain. Well, not just coming to see me, but I'd say coming to see a medical professional, because coming to see me might take a while, but just because you might need to get a referral. But coming to a medical professional, whether it's an urgent care, an ER doctor, I'd say if your eyes turn yellow, if you're jaundiced, if you start losing weight and you can't explain why you're losing weight, if you have severe abdominal pain, if you're unable to eat, right? If you can't swallow, if you see blood in the stool, those are all reasons to get to a healthcare professional immediately. Because they might not signal anything bad, but they might. And if they do signal something bad, then we need to get in there and take care of it as quickly as possible before it spreads.
Well, it sounds like in your approach, when I get to you, you're talking, you know, whether it's behavioral, nutritional, and maybe at times surgery.
Yeah. So it depends on which hat I'm wearing, right? So if I'm wearing the gastro hat versus the obesity medicine hat. For example, if somebody has elevated liver enzymes and they come to see me, I'm going to initially address it as a gastroenterologist, right? Yeah. They're being sent to me because I'm a gastroenterologist and I do liver disease. So I'm looking for viral hepatitis. I'm looking for fatty liver, of course. And if I see things in their history, like if I notice that they have class one or class two obesity, if I see that they're diabetic, I may be thinking that, oh, this is probably fatty liver, but I'm still looking for other things too. I'm looking for genetic causes for liver disease as well. And then as I start to rule some of those things out, I will start skewing the conversations over the next one or two visits towards, all right, it looks like this could be fatty liver. Let's get a fibro scan. Let's see how much fat is in your liver. Let's see how much scar tissue is in your liver. Do you know that just losing 7 to 10% of your total body weight may be able to reverse this? And so a lot of people don't know that, right? And they don't know how to do that. So that's how those conversations go. And then again, depending on what the person comes to me with, if they can't swallow, that's a completely different conversation. Now we're trying to get in there as quickly as possible to see if they have a stricture, to see if there's cancer present. So it depends on what their problem is. But there are certain things where, you know, if I'm walking down the hall and I hear that in the background, if I'm eavesdropping, you know, and I hear, oh, they can't swallow, like I stop and I'm like, get that person in immediately. Or blood in the stool, get that person in immediately. We need to take a look. Statistically, it's probably hemorrhoids, but you know, for some people, it might be Crohn's, it might be ulcerative colitis, sure. It could be colon cancer.
So there's a whole lot of things. We've talked about so many interesting things off air that it's just hard to get all this in this morning, just because it's so interesting. Sure. You were talking to us just a few minutes ago off air about sick fat disease I'd never heard of that.
Right. So this is the idea that if you have, let's say you have, and I didn't get into the different types of obesity. So traditionally we would say you have overweight or you have pre-obesity if your body mass index is between a 25 and 30. And there are calculators online, so you can calculate your body mass index. Class one would be about 30 to 35. Class two, 35 to 40. And then class three obesity would be greater than a body mass index over 40. So sick fat disease would be that traditional kind of disease that we expect. So a lot of people will have, let's say, class one, class two obesity, and they say, well, I'm not sick, because they don't have diabetes, maybe they don't have high blood pressure, maybe they don't have high cholesterol, they don't have any known heart disease. So in their minds, they're not sick. Well, that just means they don't have sick fat disease. But they could still have the other presentation of carrying excess weight, which would be fat mass disease. So fat mass disease would be the low back pain, the knee pain, right? So people end up with osteoarthritis.
Yeah.
It could be the pressure dynamic changes that occur between the abdominal cavity and the chest cavity that lead to more acid reflux. So again, with acid reflux, you lose 7 to 10% of your total body weight if you have obesity, and you can improve your acid reflux. And I've had patients come off of their acid suppression medication just because they lost 10% of their total body weight. People who carry excess body weight often develop sleep apnea. So a lot of times it can be frustrating, because I can see a patient walk in the door and I see this person maybe with class two obesity, and I think to myself, all right, you probably have obstructive sleep apnea, right? your spouse can probably tell you if you have it, because you probably keep them up at night snoring and stuff like that. So you have obstructive sleep apnea. You're thinking, all right, I make some sounds when I sleep, I stop breathing, all right, I'll be fine. Well, you probably won't be fine, because if you have that long enough, you're going to develop pulmonary hypertension. Your heart is having to work harder to push blood against all that pressure. That's going to lead to a dilated cardiomyopathy, meaning your heart is going to begin to expand, which is going to eventually lead to atrial fibrillation, an abnormal heart rhythm. Now you're going to be on a blood thinner. Now, because of that excess weight, you're going to have knee pain. You're going to be taking medicine for your knee pain. Maybe you're taking ibuprofen or Motrin or Aleve or something like that. So now you're on a blood thinner and you're on a medication like ibuprofen that can increase your risk of developing an ulcer. So now you have an ulcer, you're on a blood thinner and you bleed, and now you see me in the hospital because we're trying to figure out where the bleeding ulcer is from. So you see this cascade of events. Absolutely. And you say to yourself, well, wait a second, that knee pain wouldn't be there if you lost 10% of your total body weight. You wouldn't need the ibuprofen. You wouldn't have the sleep apnea. A lot of things wouldn't be there, right? Like, we could effectively put a lot of doctors out of business.
Yeah.
Right? But this then starts looking at the financial aspects of this too, right? So, I mean, and you can keep digging and digging. I mean, this information is out there. I mean, the Sugar Research Foundation paid off Harvard researchers back in the 60s to effectively get them to say that there is no link between eating sugar and metabolic disease. I think it was Procter & Gamble, and I'm not making this up, it's out there. This was in, I think, a JAMA article that's the Journal of American Medical Association back in 2016, that I think Procter & Gamble paid the American Heart Association the equivalent of about $20 million in today's money to get them to say that we should steer away from animal fat in favor of vegetable oils. You know, so there's a lot of money that has been thrown in.
Right.
Were people trying to be evil? I can't say that. I don't know what was in their heart. I know they were probably trying to make a profit. Maybe they didn't know what was going to happen. But if you look at when a lot of these guidelines came out in the late 70s telling us to eat low fat, and you look at the timeline for when the obesity epidemic began, it coincides perfectly, you know.
Yeah.
And you look at people like Atkins and other people who have talked about either low carb or paleo or keto or Mediterranean, South Beach, all of those diets. If it's a vegetarian, vegan, paleo, keto, Atkins, all of those can be very healthy diets. And what's interesting to me is that as I went through and read them all, because I read Atkins first, and I was like, oh, that's it. This is it. This is the way to go. And then somebody said, no, South Beach is the way to go. And I was like, oh, and I read South Beach. And I was like, oh, that looks kind of like phase two of Atkins. And then somebody said, no, you need to read about paleo. And I was like, well, this looks kind of like Atkins and South Beach. And I heard about keto. And I was like, well, this is kind of like Atkins. This is more fat and less protein. And then people were like, eat vegetarian. I was like, well, this is, and I realized, wait a second. All of these have three things in common. You're avoiding added sugars. Mm-hmm. You're avoiding ultra-processed foods. You're avoiding bad or fried foods, right? And then I thought about it even more. And I was like, you know what? I can remember being this little chunky kid running around in the 80s. And my grandfather, down in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, he was frying some vegetables one day using some bacon fat. I said, Granddaddy, don't use that bacon fat. It's not healthy. This man was like 6'1", tall, slender. I'm this little chunky kid wearing husky pants with a little husky dog on the back. And he's looking at me and he says, why shouldn't I eat this? I said, it's not healthy. And he looked at me, he said, you know what? If God put it on this earth, it's probably okay.
Yeah.
And I think to myself now, I went through medical school, residency, fellowship, all these years of practice, and I'm effectively telling people, if God put it on this earth, it's probably okay. If man made it, you should probably stay away from it. And you think about the vegetables and everything else like that, I'm like, wow. It took me like 30 years of medical practice to figure out what he told me back in 1988.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? There is so much out there, but it, as you have said, so much of this does come down to less sugar and just being smart about some
like
things.
Like literally eating real food. There are a lot of things that we call food. If you showed it to somebody from 300 years ago, they wouldn't put it in their mouth. You know, we're brainwashed to think this stuff is real food.
A bag of chips.
Yeah. So, funny story. I was chief resident at Howard University Hospital. And the funny thing about Howard University Hospital, I don't know if it's the same way now, but a lot of the internal medicine program was for medical grads. And the joke amongst the medical students was that the program was basically the United Nations and Hardy. So as one of the only American medical grads in the program, I would walk around and I would see the Nigerians over here and the Indians over here and the Caribbeans over here and the Arabs over here and the Persians over here. And there's like the whole world was represented. And then there was me. And I had to get along with everybody, right? So I had to learn to. And one day a couple Ethiopian guys were talking and they were speaking Amharic. And I learned a few words and I walked over and I said, "Hey, what are you guys talking about?" And they were kind of laughing. And they said, "Oh, we're talking about the American 10. I was like, "What's the American 10? He said, "Oh, that's the 10 pounds you gain the first year you're here." I said, "Oh, how do you gain 10 pounds the first year you get here?" And the one guy, he was an intern. He had just come over from Ethiopia. He said, "Well, where I'm from in my village, we don't have grocery stores the way you all have grocery stores." He said, "I'd never been to a grocery store. And my friend took me to an American grocery store this weekend. And it freaked me out. I didn't know what to do." I said, "Well, what do you mean? How did it freak you out?" He said, "I walked inside and it was cold." He said, "The markets that I go to, there's no air conditioning."
Yeah.
I said, "Oh, okay." He said, "And how do you have food in boxes stacked up to the ceiling?" And without thinking, I said, "Oh, well, there are preservatives in there. They keep it." And as I said that to myself, I said, "There are preservatives. There are preservatives in our food." He said, his question was, "How do you have food in boxes stacked to the ceiling for months?" And I thought about that. I said, "Wow, that's normal for me to see food stacked in boxes for months. That's not normal for him."
Yeah.
That freaked this guy out. He didn't know what to do with that. But for me, that's normal because I've been brainwashed to think that's normal. And as I've learned more about food and medicine, and as they say, food is medicine, I started to realize, like, wow, we all think that a lot of this stuff is healthy. That's not really healthy because we were told it's healthy. That doesn't make it healthy. What is it doing for you? So I tell people, and I'm a big low-carb proponent. I'm not a vegetarian person. But if somebody comes to me and they're vegetarian, I say, hey, if it's working for you, keep doing it.
Yeah.
Right? There's the art of medicine. There's the science of medicine. Science might tell me that we evolved eating meat. But if you're eating vegetarian or you're vegan and it's working for you, we'll know because we're going to run the labs. And if your labs look good, what can I tell you? I can't tell you anything. Keep doing what you're doing. Don't listen to me.
Sure.
It's working. Right? So that's the other thing with people. I try to meet people where they are and help them to get better. But if you're already doing fine, then I'll let you know, like, I have nothing to offer you. If you need help, then maybe we can work together.
Dr. Alan Hardy here with Mary Washington Healthcare. Quick break. We're going to wrap this up this morning. Good stuff on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230. You can weigh in about today's topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230 and by text at 540-371-5756. And now, here's your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Alan Hardy in this morning from Mary Washington Healthcare. Dr. Hardy, I want you to be my doctor. I want to see you. How do I get to you?
You can go to the Mary Washington Healthcare website and click on gastroenterology, and you can find me that way. I'd be listed with all of the physicians. Now, the issue is there is something called TROA, the Treat and Reduce Obesity Act. We've been trying to get that passed for the past 10 years because I'm a subspecialist, even though I'm board certified in gastroenterology. I can only treat people for obesity if they have a GI-related issue. So if somebody came to me and they have acid reflux and they also have obesity, then I can treat them. If they have fatty liver and they also have obesity, I can treat them. If they have abdominal pain and they also have obesity, then I can treat them. Because effectively, I'm going to be treating those things by helping them to lose some of their excess weight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, if you Google Dr. Alan Hardy, Mary Washington Healthcare pops up, and there's all kinds of information on your background and how to get to
certainly,
you.
Certainly.
So, what advice do you have for families trying to create healthy habits? Because this is something that families can start. Individuals, no matter where you're at,
yeah,
you can start making changes.
I would say trying to. And my wife is a pediatrician, so this is something we're trying to do with our children. But trying to avoid the ultra-processed foods and the added sugars as much as possible so that they don't develop a taste for, I guess, the artificially sweetened beverages especially too, right? So trying to kind of force water, limiting the fruit juices and stuff like that. that's just not something that I think was in the vernacular back in the 80s. So I grew up eating a lot of processed foods because, again, the focus was just on, you know, everybody's busy, eat something.
Absolutely.
Yeah, here these breakfast pastries, get out the door, right?
Yeah.
Breakfast cereals and things like that.
Pop-Tarts.
Yes. Oh, I grew up on those.
Loved them.
Yeah. So, I mean, I used to just down those things. I used to inhale them. But really trying to get back to real food. So, like, eggs and sausage and things like that. Not being afraid of real food.
That's it. And that takes some doing sometimes. Or I even understand, you talked about just, a few years ago, I love spaghetti. And people would say, you know, there's a lot of sugar in that, in some of the sauces. And I would, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Just look at a label.
Well, and so this is the whole process. Like I said, when you're doing low carb, for example, learning how many carbs are in spaghetti, because a lot of people don't realize like how many carbs are in pasta. So once you know your number, you'll know, is that something I can afford to have
right
daily? Is this something I should only have weekly? And everybody's different. So when people say, oh, you can't have pasta eating low carb, well, you can if you want to spend your carbs that way. And it depends on you as an individual, how many carbs you can have before you start to gain weight. I am built for famine. That's just like, I guess, I don't know. I will gain weight instantaneously. So I have to live pretty much at less than 30 net carbs a day. And people say, oh, I couldn't eat like that. And I'm thinking, well, I don't want to do dialysis. So that's what I'm thinking about, right? If I would love to be able to eat more carbs, because carbs taste great. I'm not doing this out of choice. I mean, I guess I'm doing it out of choice, but I'm thinking about avoiding having an early stroke.
Yeah.
I don't want to have high blood pressure. I don't want to end up on dialysis. I don't want to be diabetic. So that's the decision I'm making. It's not me versus the cookie. It's me versus dialysis, right? It's not me versus the cupcake. It's me versus high blood pressure and an early stroke. So that's the calculation. And once you realize that that's what the choice is, it's easier to make that choice.
It does. You take a look at the outcomes, because I've had to do that with donuts and cookies and a number of things that you do look at it. I feel better if I don't have it.
Yeah, yeah. And you have to understand, too, the biology. Of course you want it.
Sure.
You're going to want it. Yeah, that dopamine is right there. They've done studies. One study was interesting. They looked at rodents, and they found that rodents are more likely to want heroin than cocaine. Well, guess what? They're more likely to want a sugar solution than heroin. So it's inbred. It's in our DNA. It's in our genetics. We like sweet things. We want that release of dopamine, that feel-good hormone. So if somebody says, do you want this cookie? Of course I want it. I just have to realize I better not eat it.
Yeah.
Right. Or if I do, that's my cheat day.
Well, and I don't know that I have met a doctor like you that has had, that has the personal stories to tell. And I think that's what makes this so effective. You're living it along with everybody.
Yeah.
With all of us.
Yeah. I think... fortunately or unfortunately for me, I've been there. I know what it's like to feel frustrated. I know what it's like to be that person sitting on the plane as the big guy, and the person's hoping you're not going to sit next to them. All of those things that, you know, when you're in the locker room, you're afraid to take your shirt off because what are people going to say if they see that extra flab? Like all those things, if you're going out on a date, is she going to like me? Is she not going to like me? There are a lot of painful things that occur when you're carrying excess weight that people don't talk about. But if you've ever carried excess weight, and technically at least 60 to 70% of us in the country have, you've experienced it, you've lived it. And so knowing that, I know where people are. I know what that's like. And so I just want to help them now that I feel like I have the tools to.
Well, it's great to have you in the community. We hope you stay a long time.
Well, thanks.
And keep eating right, so you stay healthy yourself.
Thank you. Thank you. My wife said we can't move, so.
great stuff. Dr. Alan Hardy with Mary Washington Healthcare. What a great story and a great outlook toward all of this. And again, thank you very much. And if you've got some of these issues, Dr. Alan Hardy with Mary Washington Healthcare. Dr. Hardy, thanks for taking some time out and coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. We'll see you in the morning.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. Hear the show anytime by subscribing to the Town Talk podcast on your favorite podcast platform. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.